You're listening to Delve Talks, a podcast that digs into the challenges around design, product development, leadership, and innovation. Your hosts are Dave Franchino and Stephanie Nervices. Dave is the president, and Stephanie is the vice president of strategy at Delve, a design and innovation consultancy.
Welcome and hello, everybody. Once again, this is Dave Franchino, and I'm joined by my co-host, Steph Nervices, Delve's Vice President of Strategy and my business partner. As all of you know, my background is in engineering, and Steph brings a background in the social sciences and cultural anthropology. So we're going to tag team this discussion today and hopefully approach this with questions from different perspectives. And we are really excited and honored to invite Winnie Karanja, the founder and executive director of Matem. And that's a Madison-based organization which provides girls and youth of color in grades 6 to 12 skill-based training in the technology sector. So the goal is to give individuals the tools to engage and revolutionize the tech industries where traditionally women and people of color have been underrepresented. Winnie will tell us more about Matem in a bit. I know she founded it in 2015. She was her first teacher. And beyond that, she has a really fascinating background, a master's degree in developmental economics and international development from the London School of Economics and Political Science, and a bachelor's degree in child education. She's been recognized as one of Forbes 30 Under 30 and one of Wisconsin's most influential Black leaders. So just as a reminder, objective is to explore how organizations can foster a culture of innovation. And as part of that, we're having discussions with a wide range of people trying to glean insights into their experiences and what they can learn that might be applied to any field or make any corporate culture better. As an aside, in the midst of the pandemic, there are many challenges that are facing a lot of organizations that are trying to maintain a culture of creativity. And so we'll try to explore a little bit about that with Winnie as well. So would you mind diving in a little bit deeper and sharing kind of a bit about your personal journey for our listeners?
Almost definitely. Well, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm really excited to be able to have this conversation with you both and with all the listeners. So my background is I'm Kenyan American. So my family moved to the United States when I was 8 years old in 1999. And we moved straight to Madison, Wisconsin. We moved in the summertime, so that was great. Like, we weren't immersed into the wintry life yet. And my family lived in Madison for a number of years and moved out a little bit into Dane County. And just from that experience, so we moved from a neighborhood that was very diverse to a predominantly white neighborhood. And while I was in high school, so I went to high school in McFarland, Wisconsin, and I had the opportunity to take a trip to England and France. So I actually self-fundraised to go to England and France, and I just have a deep appreciation of like culture and history and architecture. And I decided from that experience that I wanted to go to do my higher education in the United Kingdom. I didn't even know that that was a thing, but I decided to do that. And throughout my sort of high school experience, I'd been, you know, passionate in social sciences, but I really was like great at math. But I continued to have these experiences where teachers and educators would push me strongly towards the social sciences. And so when I went into my undergrad degree, I studied education and then focused on international politics with that focus on emerging economies, primarily Sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia. And during that time, I started to learn how to code, worked for an international NGO, Save the Children UK, doing some stuff around data and data architecture for them for their programs in South Wales. I did my undergrad in Wales, UK. And then from there, I made that connection between my passions and technology. And so I ended up doing a lot of work in the social entrepreneurship space and in the social space around connecting data and international development work and humanitarian crisis response work. And so after that, I came back to Madison. I deferred my offer to graduate school at the London School of Economics. I worked here in Madison in workforce development for a year, and then I returned to LSE studied development economics. And then it was just really during that time where there was a lot of conversation in the UK Department of Education and the US Department of Education really talking about the importance of STEM. And so I knew, especially for the field that I was studying, that for countries not to have to play another round of catch up, it's so important that like STEM education and rigorous sort of critical thinking, logical thinking skills are really embedded into the education system. And after my graduate degree, I again moved back to Madison. So I have this, you know, pattern of returning back to Madison. And so I returned back to Madison. I was in a conversation with a former principal, elementary school principal at Falk Elementary. And in that conversation, we were talking about the importance of STEM in Nigeria and in Kenya. And she mentioned to me in passing that she reached out to a national nonprofit to teach her students how to code, and she had never heard back. I was astonished by that answer. I was heartbroken. I was perplexed. My question was, what do you mean you didn't hear back? I don't understand this. And so I immediately said, well, I can teach your students how to code. And I said, okay, let me take a couple steps back. Let me see if there's an organization locally that's doing this work. And when I started looking, the only sort of most comparative like program that I could connect her students with would not address the barriers that the students that she was working with, who were primarily students of color, low-income students, would be sort of encountering and facing entering into the STEM field. And so that's really how I started working with her, putting together some small workshops here and there. And that's where, you know, Madam came to be.
Fantastic. So tell us a little bit more about kind of the vision values behind Madam, now that we understand kind of the genesis behind it. And you've been at that for now a little more than 5 years, is that right?
Yes, yeah. So I started Madam back in 2015, and we're just hitting our fifth year this November, which is wild that it's been 5 years now. And sort of the vision of Madam is really to equip and engage girls and students of color with opportunities in the technology field. Our values focus on inclusivity. They focus on making sure that we're aware and we're checking our privilege, really, you know, respect and just very much honoring the brilliance that lies in our community. Those are the things in which Madam is very much rooted within.
So one thing I think that I'm really curious about is the process of kind of evolving Madam. And I suspect many of our listeners who might be in entrepreneurial are going to be able to relate to sort of your initial vision. I'm kind of curious, what parts of the initial vision do you look back and say, boy, I really knew right on where we were going to end up? And what parts have kind of pivoted and evolved as you've progressed through the journey?
Yeah, so I would say, the name Madam, I should explain that a little bit. So Madam is a play on sound around the phrase made by them. So for me, I really wanted to see more technology that was built by women, by people of color. And so that's where the name of the organization comes from. And so when I started the organization 5 years ago, we were actually working with rising third through 12th grade students. So quite a big age span. And it was during that time, I would say, we noticed that all of our young kids, you know, in that third through fifth graders, I mean, they were just soaking up the information. And we worked with a lot of middle schoolers. And sort of 3 years in, I started to realize that, you know, for me to be able to better communicate the work that we're doing to make an impact sooner than later in terms of having students, you know, get access to jobs that are, you know, living wage jobs, I really needed to switch and pivot that mission to really focusing on skills training towards career and or college, right? And so 2 years ago, we switched that mission to be rising 6th to 12th grade students.
Interesting. Yeah. And how hard was it to come to that recognition and to make that pivot? Was it self-evident at that period of time, or did it take some soul searching?
It definitely took some soul searching. I would say it was hard for me to let go of the students that we'd been working with in that third through fifth, just because they were so excited. So we worked with, it was probably about 70% girls, girls of color. And they would just soak in the activities that we're doing. They were so excited to come to what we called, because we did it after school and the girls would call it STEM Club. And so they were very excited to come to STEM Club and program their robots and just see, again, that same cohort of students sign up for a program the next summer. But what I actually found, which was a little bit unfortunate, is that it was hard to get funding for that program because employers were really looking to be able to fund programs that are closer to their talent pipeline and closer to folks who can be working in their corporation. So it was more of a like a business decision, I would say, rather than like a desire to sort of kind of pivot from that group of students.
You've touched on something that I'm really interested in hearing more about, which is how do students become involved, right? Because I'm thinking about this pipeline, if you will, mm-hmm. that you just mentioned, right? About understanding who leans this way, who has interest in these kinds of topics, and then nurturing that interest. So how do kids find their way to you?
Yeah, so we work with a lot of schools, getting them information about our programs. We work with a lot of community centers, and we're really trying to like get on the ground and meet families where they're at. So really connecting with counselors, minority student coordinators at the school district, working with the libraries to just provide information to the families. That's something that's just core to what we do.
Yeah. I remember an experience I had where I was walking through a after school club, and there was a young boy who was doodling like mm-hmm. these amazing drawings. And I asked him, I'm like, did you know you could do that for a living? And I blew his mind. Like nobody ever even like mentioned that to him before. So I think it must be interesting to try to get kids who don't even know what mm-hmm. STEM is.
And I would say so many of the students that we work with, I mean, have never programmed before, right? Like they write their first lines of code with us. And it's that wonderful moment where they're like, oh my word, Miss Winnie, like it worked, you know, and we've been doing a lot of stuff with Microsoft's Microbits. And so we actually had a session 2 days ago at a local community center. And when the students got their Microbits to blink hearts, they were like, oh my word, it actually did it. Like, this isn't that hard, right? And it's those kinds of experiences where, you know, you don't know what you don't know, but again, to connect this and to make it accessible, right? To make STEM accessible is something that's so important. And then to also show like, it's a lot of just like addressing problems in a different way, right? Like we're just really like amazing problem solvers, right? And so it's a lot of just reframing the conversation around STEM and who's in STEM that, you know, we prioritize ourselves in doing in MADEM programs.
Yeah. And how much are you finding you need to educate the people who are funding you or these corporate partners on what it is you're trying to do and why it's important?
Yeah, I would say it depends on the corporate partner. I think there's some that have a stronger tech focus, and so they understand the need to build a diverse talent pipeline and the need to start at a younger age group. I think there are others who need more of that support, right, and need to better understand the ways in which jobs in the STEM sector actually kind of help level the playing field for so many. And so it's a bit of that balance, but also there's a lot of education around just around everything that's happening in the community, you know, what students are facing, the importance of programs like MADEM, because a lot of the students that we work with, like I mentioned, have never written a line of code. Most students don't get that experience until they get into high school. And there's a huge drop off, first of all, of like girls in math and science going into middle school. And so by the time you get to high school, you've already lost a good portion of students. Students have already like, you know, just kind of opted themselves out of this area. And so we really have to talk to corporations about like, this is why you want to start investing early. This is why you want to start, you know, helping students have these positive experiences in STEM. Because what I say is, you know, if a student learns how to code, if they build their website, that's an experience that like no one can take from them. It's like, I built this. does not change. Like that, I built this product, right? I built this this tool, and so we really want to make sure that students are having those kinds of experiences, and then sharing with corporations, with donors, the power of that kind of experience in terms of setting students up for opportunities that are honestly outside of certain zip codes, and that there are opportunities that really are changing the trajectory of families and generations.
Winnie, that's really inspiring. I'm just kind of curious, what do you think have been some of MADEM's biggest successes or greatest successes? And then what big challenges or opportunities remain?
Yeah, I would say like one of our biggest successes have been our growth. We have grown as an organization quite significantly in the past 5 years, right? Our budget has changed each year. We were talking about that. But it's also been the number of students we've been able to reach. I think at this point, we've worked with probably close to 1,400 students. And it was always my goal in the fifth year that we would launch a program in Milwaukee. And it's always happens that within the goals that I have for MADEM, they tend to like happen in an accelerated manner. So that actually happened 3 years ago when we launched our first program in Milwaukee. And so we've done programming there for the past 2 years. We didn't do anything this year because of COVID, but I would say just those have been some pretty big successes. We have an amazing board. And so being able to just get some great people at the table, some of the amazing sponsors that we have. And I would say the successes have really been at this point, having students who worked with us, you know, back in 2016 to now see them in college, right, in pursuing computer science. One of the first ever high school students we worked with in 2016, it's just this fun story. So back in 2016 for Forward Fest, MADEM held a hackathon called Code Madison Forward. So it was high schoolers and teams of three, and they built a website and with support of a developer. The community voted on their sort of top website. And so, you know, back then I was the only person who worked at MADEM. I had an intern. And so it's, you know, boots on the ground. So here I was at the Fitchburg Public Library, you know, just putting up flyers, and these three sisters walk in and I just, you know, give them a flyer. And then, you know, a couple of days later, they sign up for the event. They had never coded before and they actually won first place. And actually the team as well that won third place was a brother and sister. And a few weeks ago, Scarlett, who is the oldest sister in that group, she reached out and she said, Winnie, I just wanted to let you know, I don't know if you remember me, I wanted to let you know that my experience with MADEM set me on the course towards STEM and computer science. It took me a long time to, you know, believe that I could do it, but I wanted to let you know that I'm at Williams College and I'm pursuing a bachelor's in computer science. I'm, you know, prospective computer science major there. And so just to see like, you know, her story, right? And just the power of that and the power of that interaction that we had. And then, you know, even some of our other students, one of my youngest students who started with us in third grade, she did two programs with us. And after she did two programs with us, she's Latina. Her brother then, because she was always talking about the website that she built, her brother then signed up for our program. He did two programs with us. And now her oldest sister, who is in high school, is doing a program with us this summer. So this summer we have like all three. And so just seeing again how the ripple effect of our programs, the word of mouth, families enrolling, and students just continuing to be like, you know, I think for me, the biggest success is students saying, I can't wait for the next MADEM program. And that just like fills my heart. And so to see that, to see students really identify that this is a place where I belong. And this is a field in which I will thrive, I'd say is one of our, some of our biggest successes. In terms of opportunities, because I know you asked me about that, Dave, I would say like, we've barely started scratching the surface. Right? Like there is so much that we can do in order to like create environments where students can start to see that the STEM field is for them. You know, for us at MADEM, something that I continuously think, something that I'm, you know, that I fight towards is really painting the picture that brilliance and success and pursuit of the field of STEM is not relegated to one racial ethnic group. And I think we have so much work to do as a community, as a society, as a corporate world, as folks who are leaders in the STEM field to say the same thing, right? And to practice the same thing and to echo this and to invest in this. And we are going to have such a high return, right? There is an insurmountable amount of brilliance in our community just right here in Madison and Dane County. And we don't do a great job of pointing and directing kids towards a field in which, like, there is such strong job stability. And so I think, again, there's so much opportunity. There's opportunities to get students into paid internships. There's opportunities to really build that talent pipeline. There's opportunities to make room for what is innovation that we haven't even thought about.
Yeah. All of that is just really thought-provoking and inspiring. It reminded me, I just wanted to share briefly, some time ago, a woman stopped me in the street and shared with me a neighbor and said that her daughter had just graduated from Purdue. And she said that she traced her love of engineering back to a presentation I gave to her in elementary school when she was like 8 years old. And I was, you know, it was really impactful because for me, it was, you know, an hour where I spent, you know, talking about what I did and why I did it. But then I remembered how, when we're very young, how impressionable we are and how easy it is to, you know, make impressions at that point of time, how impactful that can be. So you deserve to be very proud of those successes. Along those lines, though, what is something that STEM professionals don't understand or don't appreciate about the challenges that underserved populations face when trying to get into the technology or the STEM fields? What's something that we just don't understand?
I think one of the big things is just the how hard it is for people of color to get into the field, right? That there is sort of this culture around STEM. There's this, these norms, these behaviors that already exist, and people of color, if you're not part of that, you have to navigate that environment, and that's a difficult thing to do. I think there's also what I tend to run into is the fact that folks are just like, they're wondering like, well, why aren't there so many people of color? Why aren't there Blacks and Latinx in the tech field? Like, you know, and that the problem is on those communities of color rather than the structures, the systems, the ways in which we've always taught STEM and the kinds of environment that has been laid out. And I would say those are things that are important to consider. And that problem doesn't start in college. It starts a lot earlier.
So let me ask you about that. I guess in one aspect, could you say that MADEM's success actually represents some bit of a failure in the traditional educational systems, or maybe better phrased, how have the traditional education systems failed in promoting STEM for underserved groups, and how could they improve?
Yeah, so I would say MADEM is a response of the lack of STEM education in, and I would say specifically, you know, technology education in the traditional schooling system. In terms of ways in which traditional school can improve, I mean, the thing is that there's so much happening within the traditional schooling environment that I think personally we need to rethink schools. So not in the way that schooling and education sort of happens, but within that context, there's been so many times where, and even myself, you know, I was pushed away from the hard sciences. I struggled in chemistry and I got very little support. And so that meant that I couldn't you know, go on and take physics. And the reason I'm actually not an engineer today is because of that, right? But you have so many students who will come up to me and who'll be like, Miss Winnie, I tried to sign up for AP calculus and my counselor told me that, you know, she asked me, you know, are you sure you want to take that? Right? You have so many educators who don't necessarily believe in the brilliance of students, right? And so they're going to push them towards things that they believe, oh, you can do this or this is easier. And that's a problem, right? Like not being able to challenge students to, you know, grow and develop to their best, and also not being there to support them, right? And to understand that students have different learning styles, and to, and also to even share examples of people of color and pioneers in the STEM field who look like them and who reflect them, right? Like at, in our programs in MADEM, especially, we just finished one of our programs, and you know, the students, the girls are building, they built a website around a woman in STEM who inspires them. And so they had to research that. And as they were doing their presentations, because all of our summer programs this year are virtual, so, you know, the students are on Zoom. And, you know, they were presenting on like Katherine Johnson and, you know, talking about the things that she's been able to, that she accomplished, right? Talking about Mae Jemison. And so I think we don't, you know, we relegate sort of like pioneers or people of color to like Black History Month or, you know, Hispanic Heritage Month. And we need to really integrate that. We need to show that this is a field in which you belong, in which you thrive. We need to support students in math and in science and in reading and connect them to these fields. I think in addition to that, you know, tech is continuously changing and it's hard to keep up with that. And within that scope, educators might not necessarily know these are the jobs that are in the tech field. And you can, you know, just like you're saying, Stephanie, right? Like stopping and talking to that young student and saying like, did you know that this is a job you could have? And I think part of it is that there isn't necessarily that expertise. And so you do need programs that have that very laser-eyed focus to support students. And you also need educators and counselors who are going to, do the work themselves and really kind of like tackle their own, you know, their own sort of like prejudice, stereotypes, all of those things, all those biases, and be able to better support students.
So when you provocatively implied a second ago that, you know, there's ways that you think education fundamentally needs to change. Mm-hmm. And having spent your, not just your career, but your education studying the educational system, I'm not going to let you off that easily. If you were king of the world, how would you fundamentally re-engineer, if I can use that phrase, redesign our educational system to better address this issue?
Yeah, that is, Dave, you did not let me off with that one. And I would say if I was queen of the world, I would make smaller class sizes. I would make it experiential. I would have it have a strong focus on being student led in certain ways. I think Finland has done a really great job in that. Like students don't start kind of in school until they're 7 years old, and they have some of the, you know, sort of best outcomes in terms of education. And so I think there are things like that that we can do. I would say wraparound support systems, right? The initiatives right now that schools are doing around becoming community schools and really involving parents in that and helping support, you know, families with, you know, food, with just different sorts of assistance. Those are critical because if you go home and let's say you're in an unstable housing situation or just different things like that, it's hard to learn. And so I would say these very curated experiences in which educators know the families, know the challenges, it means that they're better able to support the students and they're better able to support the families. So that's what I would say. I mean, it would be a huge undertaking.
But a really prescriptive list, I think, with some very actionable things, which I think is really valuable for all of us to hear, you know, that there are perhaps better ways to systemically look at things that we accept as being given and to say, no, there's different ways to reinvent that. And I think that's some of the things MADEM can do. That was a very philosophical question. Let me pull you out of the clouds then and back down to earth. And the reality is that the pandemic has presented lots of challenges for everybody. Educational programs are right in the cusp of that. I know you've had to move your offerings online and kind of react to that. What challenges it presented? How have you responded to the challenges of pursuing your mission and your vision in the midst of this terrible pandemic?
Yeah. Yes, I would say so much has happened in the past couple months for us in terms of supporting our students and families. So one of the big things when the pandemic hit, and we were in March right before the Safer at Home order here in Madison, is we had planned to do a spring break program in person. And we quickly realized that was not going to happen. And so we actually immediately canceled it. And then we just took a step back and said, well, let's see if students are interested in still doing this in a virtual environment. And they said yes. And so in about 2 weeks, we took what is an all day, Monday through Friday spring break course and placed it virtually. And, you know, that was really, really successful. We learned a couple of things from that program. One of the things I would say that I'm very proud of my team has just been the ways in which we have been focused and intentional to build community amongst students in that virtual platform, because a couple of the students knew each other, but most of them didn't. And so really just helping them build relationships and bond and come into community right away was something that was very important. Getting ready for our summer programs. Again, we knew that, you know, we couldn't not provide programming, because we know that there's already an achievement gap, and that COVID-19 is going to widen the achievement gap. And honestly, like, students are the collateral damage of, you know, one of this pandemic, right? Not being able to have access to the resources, the support, etc. And so for 8 weeks we put out virtual activities for families and for students to do. And we had a great turnout. I think we've had over 400 students like engage in those activities that we released out online, and they were free. And coming into summer programs, which is our biggest time of programming, you know, we knew that everybody was running into Zoom fatigue. We knew that students, you know, all of this is affecting them in so many different ways. And so we wanted to create an environment where they weren't just on the computer learning, but that they had activities to do that were sort of unplugged, really building upon and cementing some of the fundamentals that they were learning. And so what we decided to do there was just get some resources together, package up kits for families to pick up safely before the program, alongside laptops. We actually issued out a good number of our laptops right at the beginning of the pandemic. So students who worked with us actually ended up having laptops before the school district got them out. And then every one of our summer students has a laptop that we issued out. And so being able to support the students in that way was something that was very important to us. The challenge was honestly taking a program that's the, you know, a combination of technical skills, mentorship, and exposure, right? Like these site visits that we do in person to companies, we're now really thinking about how do we get students the exposure to different companies while they're not there in person because we can't go in person. How do we do that in a virtual platform? How do we also do mentorship well in a virtual platform? And so those are things that we've kind of been doing, you know, breakout rooms with two mentors to students. We've reached out to companies who have done virtual site visits and having folks come and speak and interact with students. And so again, I think there's a number of challenges. One that we sort of offered resources to, and I would have loved to be able to do more, is around food. 70% of our students who were in our summer program received free reduced lunch. And so we wanted to figure out, and then during our summer program, students are with us all day for 3 weeks, 5 weeks, or 8 weeks. And so we provide them with the food as well. And so those were things that we really had to think through. And we also had to think through the fact that, like, everybody's home environment, again, is so different. And so, you know, you have some families where there's multiple kids and you're in you're all in like a smaller space. And so again, just really creating an environment where learning can happen and having grace, extended grace for like our students and our families around a number of those things. And that's meant that, like, you know, sometimes we're on calls. I mean, we're, you know, programming in the class and there's a little sibling like sitting with the other sibling, and it is what it is. And, you know, sometimes there's, you can hear people in the background, and, you know, but like those aren't things that are deterring students, right? Like students are showing up and they're saying, okay, I'll be there at 1 right after lunch, because we do morning sessions and afternoon sessions. And so just to see that determination of students to continue to like do the program has been something that's exciting, but it's been a big challenge.
That's great work. And I, you know, none of us planned on any of this, but it's tested all of us as leaders, and those of you who are in the field of education, probably even more so. So my admiration, respect, not only for keeping the mission going, but keeping it going during these very uncertain times. Winnie, you know, as you know, this is a podcast that's focused on creating a culture of innovation. And how do you articulate why creating increased opportunities for girls and children of color is so critical to innovation?
Yeah. Well, in 2018, there's a report that came out, a study by the Equality of Opportunity Project, that showed that children at the top of their third grade math class are more likely to become innovators and inventors, but only if they come from high income families. Because these are the students that have the necessary exposure to inventors and inventions. And what the article put together, essentially in the data that they collected, because they looked at a significant amount of years of US patents that were filed, and essentially it came to the conclusion that becoming an inventor in the US is reliant on two things: being excellent in math and science and coming from a wealthy family. And what it showed was that if women and people of color and children from low-income families invented at the same rate as high-income white men, the innovation rate in America would quadruple. And this article, I think, I love the way that's called The Lost Einsteins.
It is absolutely breathtaking.
Yeah. And I think about, you know, the types of innovations we're missing out, right? The types of like problems we're not able to solve because students just don't have that exposure to inventors and inventions, right? And that to me is why, like, again, why program like MADEM, you know, matters. Also, just like from an economical perspective, like there's so much that we collectively lose out when people of color, when folks who are low income don't have access and don't have access in this regard to inventors and to innovations. And so that's why I think it's so important.
Excellent. That's a great way to phrase it, and a really compelling study. Winnie, for our country, the last couple of months have been hard. Aside from the pandemic, we've seen some pretty deep pain and anguish around the areas of social justice. At the same time, I suspect that that's contributed to some increased awareness. And I'm just curious, what keeps you up at night and what makes you feel optimistic?
Yeah, so what keeps me up at night is, I guess I continue to reflect, and I wonder if when these conversations no longer remain the front of headlines, will they still be relevant to the minds of decision makers? That's what definitely keeps me up at night. And one of the things that does make me optimistic about this time is that people are having conversations and people are taking time to learn. They're taking time to ask questions and to reflect. And my hope is that that's, you know, in certain ways, I think that's driving towards change, and we've seen a number of things change, you know, within sort of policies and, you know, police officers and schooling, things like that. And so I'm optimistic that there is a little bit of change, but I'm cautiously optimistic, right? So, yeah.
I guess I'm positive that there are people listening to this podcast that are inspired and like-minded individuals who are looking to make a difference in opportunities for underserved communities, but don't know where to start. What advice would you have for people as an entrepreneur in this area, as somebody who's been successful and made a difference? What advice would you have for other like-minded individuals who really want to make a difference in opportunities for underserved individuals?
Yeah, I would say for folks who want to make a difference, are we talking about white people who want to make a difference or people of color who want to make a difference, I guess?
Am I allowed to say both, please?
Okay, yes. Yeah, you can say both. So I think one of the biggest things for me when I started Madum, I wasn't looking to start anything. It was because there was a gap and there wasn't anything like where I could even try and say, let's pilot this under your arm, right? And I would say at this time, I'm not sure we need to create new organizations, new entities. I always tell individuals, like, who is working with that same group of people? And then how do you come and you partner alongside them? How do you come and you support them with your time, your finances, your expertise, and your resources? So that's what I would say. I would say the other thing is, I would encourage people to read and to learn and to hold others accountable. There's so much that you can learn around why things are the way that they are in your community and historically what has led to that. You can also learn just like nationally why things are the way that they are. And so I would say one thing I really want people to do is to like to do the self-learning, right? To work on themselves, to realize that this is long-haul work. And then when they show up in communities of color, to come in as a listener and to say, okay, so this is what you need. How do I come alongside you? Rather than this is a solution that I'm here to bring and impose, right? But what are the things that you're seeing you need? And then how do I help make that a reality? The folks who are coming and helping amplify the voices of Black leaders, helping amplify the voices and the work that's being done by people of color at a grassroots, at a national level. That is such for me that I think I wouldn't underestimate that. So those are the things that I would say, but really just a lot of partnerships. To be honest, again, I like to reiterate, there's not anything that's really like new under the sun, right? So come alongside folks, partner with them, help them continue to do the work that they're doing, whatever that looks like, and even pilot the new initiatives with their sort of groups and the communities. So
that's fantastic. Steph, any last questions for Winnie?
I was really curious about, you know, there's just so many people out there who had their awareness raised to some degree and who want to do something and don't know how or what. And I think just knowing that Madum exists, and I really appreciate your conversation about coming alongside and partnering with groups that already exist in our local communities is great advice.
Yeah.
And being a listener. Somebody in another podcast said we need to learn how to be listeners with the intention of learning.
Yeah.
Rather than listening with the intention of responding. So
agreed.
I really appreciate the advice. So thank you.
Along those lines, for our listeners, there'll be information below this podcast on how to support and get involved in Madum. And Winnie, it's been a real pleasure and honor. Once again, our guest today was Winnie Karanja, founder and executive director of Madum, who's a Madison-based organization that provides girls and youth of color in grades 6 through 12 with skill-based training in the technology sector. And the goal is to give those people tools to engage and revolutionize the tech industry where women and people of color have traditionally been underrepresented. Winnie, thank you so very much for your time. You should be very proud of your success and the areas in which you're focusing, and look forward to continued collaborations with you in the future.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dave and Stephanie. This has been wonderful to be on the podcast and really enjoying working with you guys and your team. So thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find more podcast episodes, articles, and other resources on design and innovation at dell.com.